Today, we ask the latest MP to resign from the Conservatives whether Brexit has broken the party. And The Guardian's Dream McClinton on colourism, the particular discrimination faced by black people with darker skin.
Well, the curious thing of the House of Commons is that, you know, it is a sort of cockpit of theatre. Everything is sort of in that quite small, intimate space, and everybody can see everybody.
Point of order from Mr. Nicholas Bowles.
There is a sort of rushing in noise in your ears. You can't really hear anything or anyone.
On a point of order, Mr. Speaker, I have given everything to an attempt to find a compromise.
One could tell from my voice that I was finding it quite difficult to keep control of my emotions.
I accept I have failed. I have failed chiefly because my party refuses to compromise.
And that I knew I wanted to say. What I didn't really know was what was then the logical conclusion of that.
I regret, therefore, to announce that I can no longer sit for this party.
Oh, Nick, don't go. Come on.
It's almost 3 years since Britain voted to leave the EU. But as Theresa May heads for Brussels, after visiting Berlin and Paris to beg for yet more time, she knows that this process is shattering political bonds within her own party. Last week, Nick Bowles became the Tories' fourth Brexit resignation.
Part of it was the desire to send an electric shock through the system and just say, you can't carry on giving in to the hardliners, the ideologues, and never actually giving in to the pragmatists and the moderates. We can't be taken for granted, and that we do have a limit beyond which we won't be pushed.
Now sitting as an independent, he thinks the time has come to be blunt about a party that is hemorrhaging young voters. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, can the Conservative Party survive Brexit? So you recently quit the Tory party in quite a dramatic and emotional way. What was running through your mind when you made the decision?
I've been feeling pretty unhappy and perhaps even more importantly uncomfortable about being a Conservative MP for quite a number of months now. And I've had a difficult time with my local party, and I had to part company with them a few weeks ago. And I've also had a very difficult time with, you know, a great many of my colleagues in Westminster in the Conservative Parliamentary Party, obviously, especially those who belong to this, you know, the European Research Group, the sort of hard Brexiters. But having said that, I had no idea that I was going to do what I did, even 5 minutes before, let alone, you know, 5 hours before.
Just totally on the hoof.
Totally on the hoof, but it was the straw that broke the camel's back in that classic way. You know, I have spent many, many months trying to not just construct a compromise for Brexit that I thought that, you know, would bring people together, that Remainers and Leavers and MPs of different parties would be able to support, not just construct it, but also win support for it. And I thought, my God, this is amazing. We've actually managed to get, you know, the two biggest parties of opposition to sign up to this thing. All I need now is for a decent number of Conservatives to back it, and I'll have the majority that has been eluding everyone for months now. And then what turns out is that the one group of people who's absolutely stubbornly refused to compromise is my own party. You know, I just couldn't imagine returning the next day and pretending that these were my, you know, soulmates and my, you know, natural colleagues in politics.
Well, they were shouting, "Don't go, Nick." I mean, how did you feel?
Well, one shouted, "Don't go, Nick."
Oh, there's loads, weren't there?
No, I suspect quite a few were thinking, "Thank God he's gone." you know, it was a shocking thing because it shocked me as well that I'd done it.
It feels as though Brexit has crystallised tribal divisions within the Conservative Party. What groupings are there at the moment, and who belongs where?
I think that one of the questions to which I don't know the answer, is to what extent is the divide between hard Brexiters, the ones who basically implacably refuse to vote for the Prime Minister's deal, and the rest of the parliamentary party. What I don't think is yet completely clear is whether it's a division on other issues. And the question for Conservative MPs and most importantly for voters is which Conservative Party is going to be in the fore once two things happen. One, we leave the EU and are into the second phase of negotiation. And two, of course, once Theresa May has stepped down and they're electing a new leader. Is it going to be the Conservative Party of David Cameron, of Ruth Davidson, of Amber Rudd? Or is it going to be the Conservative Party of Boris Johnson and Andrea Leadsom and Steve Baker? And we will get an answer pretty soon. And I think that that will tell a lot of people about what direction the party is heading in.
Given that there are now these at least two big tribes in the Conservative Party and that they feel really quite passionately differently about the biggest issue facing our country at the moment, has that totally changed the mood? I mean, when you're walking around in Parliament, do you feel shunned in the tea room? Do people still sit together in the chamber?
Almost everybody in Parliament makes a real effort not to allow their disagreements about policy or even huge questions like Brexit to infect their personal relationships and the way in which they just rub along with colleagues. However, for all we try and maintain sort of cordial and polite interpersonal relationships, we're quite cross about this. I mean, I'm really cross about what the hard Brexiters are doing. I think it is deeply, grossly irresponsible, reckless, damaging. And I'm sure they're equally cross with me. I think they probably think that I'm frustrating the will of the people, denying them their prize they've been working for decades.
I can see your crossness on your face. What does Jacob Rees-Mogg look like when he's cross?
Well, I mean, he is, you know, he prides himself on being a particular kind of English gentleman, and he maintains that attitude at almost all times. But even Jacob, I would say, I've noticed in recent weeks, the mask has slipped a bit.
And speaking of Jacob Rees-Mogg, I mean, he recently stood up in Parliament and he called you a Wickhamist.
My honourable friend makes a characteristically Wickhamist point, highly intelligent. Highly intelligent, but fundamentally wrong.
Obviously, we had to Google what this meant, and it was a reference to the public schools that you both went to, and this was essentially an old Etonian having a pop at someone from Winchester. I mean, don't you think this makes the party look incredibly out of touch? Is there a risk that it almost becomes a parody of itself?
I mean, I don't know what it says about the party. I just bluntly think that a 50-year-old man who uses somebody's schooling as a way to respond to a pretty serious point about a pretty serious issue is rather desperately clutching at straws.
In some ways, you'll be depicted as a sort of uber moderniser as a result of this. But when it comes to Brexit, you came out of a hospital bed to vote to trigger Article 50. You've backed Theresa May's deal. You're hardly an uber Remainer. You haven't joined the independent group.
I mean, I am an uber moderniser. I like to think of myself as the uber moderniser, that there's nobody more uber than me. But on Brexit, you're right that I have consistently, ever since the morning after the referendum, felt that this was a very big political moment, but not just a big political moment, a big moment for British society, and that it was very important to honour it. And that's why I left hospital in the middle of a chemotherapy session to vote for Article 50. And it's why I voted for the Prime Minister's deal three times. It's why I consistently say that I won't support a second referendum. For all that I totally understand why people think that it's essential or justified, I can't share that view. I do believe we need to leave the EU. And I really, really believe that. You know, there are lots of Labour MPs who also, like me, voted Remain, like Lucy Powell and Stephen Kinnock, who I've been working with on my compromise proposal, who believe we need to leave.
Your eyes light up when you talk about your new Labour friends.
I know. I refer to them as my Labour crushes. I do find there's something, I mean, and I don't, I want to be very clear, I find this in many conservative colleagues too, but there is something very refreshingly direct, brave, principled, but also human about Lucy Powell and about Jess Phillips and various others I've been working with. And it's been a total pleasure to discover them through this experience.
So here you are, you're presenting yourself as a liberal, modernising, centrist politician. What I don't understand is why, back in 1997, when you were deciding which political party to join, you went for the Tories, when the other choice was Tony Blair and New Labour.
At the time, I felt very strongly that I didn't want to be the most right-wing member of the Labour Party. I didn't
so you
want
went for
to
the
be
the most left-wing member of the Tory Party.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's as simple as that, really. I didn't want to be the guy who was always arguing for the market or restraining public spending or spending more on defence or being willing to, you know, fight when something really important is happening in the world, which I would have been within Labour. I felt much more naturally comfortable being inside the Conservative Party, particularly coming in at a time when it was about to crash out to the biggest defeat in electoral history, that I would come in and try and be one of the people who revived it and renewed it and hopefully changed it, modernised it. It is basically what I've done for the last 20 years.
Look, you've argued that you were this great moderniser, and it was painted as a modernisation. I mean, we had hoodies, we had huskies.
We, the people in suits, often see the hoodies as aggressive, the uniform of a rebel army of young gangsters. But for young people, hoodies are often more defensive rather than offensive.
But in the end, you came into power and it was really all about austerity. I mean, is that what you came into politics for?
No, and of course, you know, as politicians, you only get to choose a small bit of what you have to work on, because you get presented with events, with what's in fact going on in the world. And when we came into office, I don't think David Cameron for a second thought that he was going to be defined as the Prime Minister of austerity. But when you come into office with a budget deficit of, you know, well over 10% of our national income, you don't really have a lot of choice. And there are other examples in other countries.
I mean, you didn't have to blame an international financial crisis on the Labour Party. I mean, wasn't that politically opportunistic?
No, I mean, in politics, you make your arguments and you try and win support. But the question is, what do you do?
In late 2016, you were diagnosed with cancer for the second time and you had grueling treatment. How did that change your life?
I was probably animated by the same fairly predictable ambitions of most members of parliament. I wanted to get into the cabinet. I wanted to be able to make some big changes that would carry my name, you know, and who knows, probably on the odd occasion I'd lie awake dreaming of being prime minister or something like that. That all changed, really. It began to change probably the first time I was ill, but it really all changed this second time. And I just no longer measure success or service or contribution in the same way. And I think being true to myself, being honest with the people who elected me about what I think is in their best interests, that is now hugely more important to me than my position or my future trajectory.
Because you think that a no-deal Brexit would be so damaging to your constituents?
Yes, but also perhaps even more importantly than that, but that I believe that over the last 12 months, I have tried to identify what is the right thing to do, what is in the national interest and the interest of my constituents. And I have basically dedicated everything to it. I haven't, cut corners, I haven't hedged my bets, I haven't tried to position myself for a future leadership election, I haven't tried to get close to this candidate or that candidate. I really try to focus on what is in people's best interests as I see them. And I think that that is a function of the state of mind that many people probably acquire after a big sort of life shock of the kind that, you know, a very, very serious illness is.
Where you think that you might not be able to carry on.
Yes, and where you just, but probably even bigger than that, it's not so much about you, is what matters? What's important? What do you want to remember whenever your days come to a close? Do you want to remember that you were Secretary of State for Transport, you know, and, you know, managed to make a particular railway project come in only 3 years late and five times over budget? Or do you want to be remembered for having stood up at a moment of sort of national importance, you know, at a moment where really there's a lot at stake, and argued for something difficult but right? And I know that that is more important to me than anything else.
You recently tweeted, "I'm no longer a member of the Conservative Party, so I can be blunt where previously I might have been discreet." So now you stepped away from the party and you're ready to be blunt. Do you believe Theresa May has put party before country?
Yes, until this week. Theresa May has put party before country, and that has been, in a sense, her downfall. But I'm glad to say, better late than never, she now seems to be putting country before party. And if that is her final contribution as Prime Minister, then I think that the public and history will honour her for it.
So we need to talk about 2016. And the last Tory leadership campaign, because you initially backed Boris Johnson for leader after your friend Michael Gove persuaded you to, and you were pretty quick to switch away from him. Having seen Boris in action, what will his next campaign manager have to contend with?
You know, I worked closely with him when he was first elected mayor of London.
You were chief of staff.
I was chief of staff while they were finding a permanent chief of staff. And so I observed him very, very closely. And, you know, at his best, he has an ability to communicate with people at a sort of level of gut.
If I have a function here today, it is to try, with all humility, to put some lead into the collective pencil.
You know, not some boring politician banging on about policy, but a real human being showing their humanity, engaging with somebody else and sort of just creating enthusiasm. But the problem is that it's completely unpredictable.
Chafing was involved, but...
I thought you wrote in your book. You said it got very, very tight around your groin area.
Did it? Right. Well, if that's why I wrote my book, it must be absolutely correct.
And with it comes chaos and inability to make decisions and a sort of rootlessness, a lack of commitment to any particular idea or belief or principle. Now, the question is, which do you get and what do people want?
Well, the real Boris Johnson, please stand up type thing.
Yes, I think that there are perhaps many real Boris Johnsons.
Is he unfit to be Prime Minister?
I don't believe that Boris Johnson is fit to be Prime Minister, no.
And do you admire people like Amber Rudd? There is talk now of her potentially taking a lot of modernisers to back Boris.
I don't believe for one second that Amber Rudd is going to back Boris Johnson to be Prime Minister. The truth is, you know, she was a strong potential candidate herself. And she took a conscious decision that rather than try and preserve her ability to run and win, that she was going to stand up for what she believed in on Brexit. And she, as a result, made herself quite awkward in cabinet and has been absolutely crucial part of what has led the Prime Minister to the point that she's at now, seeking a compromise. And I admire her hugely for it.
And do you think that the whole Brexit campaign, because of its divisive nature, has made... actually, both him and Michael Gove have a real problem now with the electorate as a whole because they will be seen as divisive figures.
So I come to the view that actually nobody who has been involved in either the referendum campaign or the chaotic and painful attempt to deliver the Brexit result should be the next Prime Minister of this country.
Including Michael Gove.
Yeah. I mean, one of my closest friends and I'm a huge fan of him as a reformer in government. But I believe that we need an entirely fresh face, but not just a face, that's sort of trivialising it, that we need a fresh force in British politics. I hope that the Conservative Party will spend the next 6, 9, however many months it is, investigating very widely who that might be. But I don't believe that it's likely to be somebody from the existing cabinet.
Yesterday, Tory leadership hopefuls lined up to warn the party about the risk of losing young voters. A cabinet minister, Matthew Hancock, said that people used to think about voting Tory
when they got their first paycheck, and now is something people start to do when they get their first winter fuel allowance.
Polls suggest that not just young people, but people right up to their 50s are now more likely to support Labour than the Conservatives. Isn't that an existential threat to the party?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you can't be in a position where people in their 30s and 40s, right up until their early 50s, are fundamentally less likely to consider voting for you, and that people in their 20s and 30s, vanishingly few of them even think it's an option to vote for you. That is not a sustainable or survivable place to be. It can be turned round, but it requires quite urgent surgery and strong leadership from somebody who is convincingly new. And those are all things that it needs to do, and even then it will be hard.
Nick, I was going to finish by saying, Nick, don't go. But I think it's got all far too serious now. So I'll just say thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was former Tory MP Nick Bowles. As Theresa May heads into an emergency EU summit today, follow all the reporting of our Brussels and Westminster teams at theguardian.com. Coming up, we talk a lot about racism, but what about colourism? Welcome back. Now, Dream McClinton, a Guardian US editorial fellow, talks about colourism. Not just discrimination against black people, but particularly those with darker skin tones.
I had just moved down to Georgia. I was 12, and I was in this class. We were watching a documentary about slavery, and two girls were sitting in front of me. I still remember their names. I still remember exactly what they looked like. One was biracial. The other was white. The biracial girl was the only other black girl in the class at the time. And the movie was explaining the difference in treatment between slaves. Darker-skinned enslaved people would be out in the fields versus the lighter-skinned, who were often the descendants of slave masters and raped slave women. During us watching this documentary, one of the girls, the white girl, turned to the biracial girl and said, "What kind of slave would you be?" Which is already a terrible question to ask. But the biracial girl turned to her and she said something to the effect of, "I would be a house slave and Dream would be a field slave." Even as a 12-year-old, I think emotionally and mentally and intellectually, I just kind of knew that from that moment on, nothing would ever quite be fair for me. It absolutely has had an effect on what I view as my trajectory, as in my personal life, in my dating life, in my family life. It is something that is so pervasive and so permeating to the point where I don't know what my life would have been like had I not faced this systematic oppression. There are certain men that I've dated who won't hold my hand in public. They wouldn't want to be seen with me in public. There are certain organizations in the South and in across America who wouldn't like to have me as the face of it, and therefore they kind of shuffle me to the back. There are certain family members who have said to my face, I'm prettier because I'm light-skinned and I'm always going to be the prettier one. It's like a boulder, you know, like as soon as somebody points out the boulder, you notice that there's a weight on you. But moving throughout everyday life, you have to sort of disassociate yourself from the boulder in order just to move. There are so many areas that colorism affects. Darker skinned girls in school, they're 3.5 times more likely to be suspended than lighter skinned girls. Dr. Matthew Harris found that in job interviews, often light skin carries more weight than even levels of education because of systematic racism and the tolls that systematic racism takes on the body. Darker skinned women often have more health risks. 55% of light-skinned women had been married versus 23% of dark-skinned women. What we're missing with race is the nuance and the subtleties and the variations that also carry throughout daily life. I think the first step is understanding the issue of colorism and being able to acknowledge that colorism is pervasive and affects the lives of daily people. Whether or not people talking about it will help, I am totally not sure. We need policy. We need actual action to change these instances of prejudice. There's no way that we're going to change prejudice by just talking about it.
That was Dream McClinton. Please do read her excellent piece on the website. It's part of a week-long series called Shades of Black, which features 27 women speaking out about the taboo of colorism and is well worth your time. Now, I'm delighted to tell you that Today in Focus has been nominated in two categories of the British Podcast Awards, Best New and Best Current Affairs, thanks to our absolutely amazing team of producers. There is also a Listener's Choice Awards, and so I've got a favour to ask. If you're enjoying our work, then please do consider voting for us. Go to www.britishpodcastawards.com/vote. That's all for today. My thanks to Nick Bowles and Dream McClinton. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Mithali Rao and Amy Walker. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.